From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. The Olympic flame will be doused tomorrow, but there's so much slipping and sliding left ahead on Only a Game. One last look at the Vancouver Games. Also, a member of the 1980 gold medal hockey team wonders what that accomplishment will mean 50 years after the fact. And a few minutes of heck with accomplished and sometimes controversial basketball coach Nolan Richardson and his biographer. Also, the Boston Area Sports League dedicated to the well-being of abused and neglected kids.
I'm brought to tears at least 5 times every Tuesday night. In a way, it's almost like what you want all sports leagues to be about is this level of personal development in conjunction with playing a competitive sport.
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. In the highly anticipated women's curling final yesterday, Sweden upset Canada to win a gold medal. The final score in that encounter was 7-6. Apollo Anton Ono captured his 8th medal in speed skating as a member of the U.S. 5,000-meter relay team. It was bronze. He lost what would have been yet another medal when he was disqualified in the 500-meter final for interference. On the women's side, China's Wang Meng captured her 3rd gold medal in speed skating by winning the 1,000-meter event. This is the final weekend of the 21st Winter Olympic Games, so it's only right and proper that we bid them adieu with the help of John Powers, who is in Vancouver to cover the games for the Boston Globe. Hi, John.
Hello, Bill.
There is a lot of excitement surrounding today's men's curling gold medal game featuring the host nation and Norway. Which curling superpower do you think will prevail?
Well, Canada needs this. I mean, as important as hockey is to the national psyche, curling is the sport that they really think is theirs. And, of course, when the Chinese women won the world title last year, it was consternation here. It's one thing. At least they don't have to worry about the Americans beating them in it.
The Canadian women took curling silver last night. If they had won the gold, there would have been jubilation in the streets, I'm sure. Is there any way to convey to our listeners in the U.S. just how much curling means to Canadians?
Well, I think this is a sport that they feel that they invented. They think it's fairly simple to explain, especially to an American. I asked one of them once, what do I need to know? He said just 3 things: skip, whoa, and where's the Labatt's rep?
Hey, wait a minute. That's the Canadian women's hockey team.
That's right. Any game where you can drink indoors is good for Canadians.
On Thursday, the women's figure skating gold went to South Korea's Kim Yuna after a most memorable competition. I can't imagine the Japanese silver medalist Mao Asada or the Canadian bronze medalist Joanne Rochette feel all that badly about being runners-up in this, do you?
I think they were quite happy. It was a wonderful performance by Kim, who's under extraordinary pressure back home. She was the world champion, and of course, Korea not only had never won a gold medal in figure skating, they never won any medal in figure skating. But of course, yesterday, the big battle took place before dawn between the Korean and the Japanese photographers when they were trying to get photo positions ringside.
Well, tell me more.
This is the thing. Basically, Kim is Grace Kelly back home. I mean, she is followed everywhere by paparazzi. Mao Asada clearly is a former world champion. She is the big gun. What's remarkable is Mao landed 2 triple axels. It's never been done by a woman at the Olympic Games and still gets pummeled in the free skate.
U.S. female figure skaters failed a medal for the first time since 1964, but given the way Mirai Nagasu and Rachel Flatt skated on Thursday, are these U.S. skaters likely to be competitive at the 2014 Games?
I think this may be the last you've seen of Rachel Flatt. She starts college next year, possibly at Stanford, and I think this may have been her swan song. But Mirai Nagasu is only 16. She had a wonderful year, especially after a dreadful year last year, and as she says, her first name in Japanese means future.
Does Kim Yuna's figure skating gold medal take away some of the sting of South Korea's controversial disqualification in the women's 3,000-meter speed skating relay back on Wednesday?
I think it does, if only because this is a sport in figure skating. The Koreans have had no presence, so this puts them on a map, not only in that sport, but it basically means that one of their women is the world ice goddess. She's the ice queen. She's the people want to be. And even better, when the Japanese skater is below her on the podium, it doesn't get better than that for Korea.
Regarding that 3,000-meter event, the speed skating event, have you ever seen winners looking so sheepish as the bronze medal winners did circling the rink after that race was over?
Well, as the short trackers like to say, that short track, they think it's a very karmic sort of sport, that eventually you will win something you don't deserve, and eventually you will lose something that you deserve to win. So the one who knows that better than all is Apollo Anton Ono, who won his first medal by crawling across the finish line in 2002.
The women's hockey gold medal went to Canada and the silver to the U.S. Where have I heard that before? Anyway, IOC President Jacques Roger recently said the competition gap between those two teams and the rest of the world must be closed, or women's ice hockey would face possible elimination 8 years hence. Do you think Roger is in earnest when he says this?
I think what he wants to see is more competition, third, fourth, fifth places. If anything, the depth of women's hockey seems to be getting worse since the sport was put in 1998. Of course, most of the people here think, let's just have the Americans and Canadians in a best of seven, just like the Stanley Cup. First of four wins it all.
You've been following the Olympic Games for more than three decades. You've witnessed many instances of relatively unheralded athletes making names for themselves during this two-week-plus period. What were your favorite stories of that sort this time around?
Well, the amazing thing was, again, the U.S. Nordic combined team. I mean, here is a team that's never done anything. As a matter of fact, I think it was 86 years relative to the Red Sox. And for them to medal basically in every event, to get gold and silver medals, was just remarkable. I don't know whether this is going to be having kids jumping off their rooftops at home, but it was one
with
of the
skis
heartwarming
on
stories.
One hopes.
Exactly. And, of course, it was very symbolic. Billy DeMong, who won the gold medal, is going to be carrying the American flag in the closing ceremonies.
Well, you bring up a really interesting point, John. One wonders if the sports of biathlon, Nordic combined, and maybe even curling will have gained traction, no pun intended, because of these games.
Well, I think certainly biathlon is the new French food. They did very well in this thing. Now, you would think that skiing and shooting is not something that the French do well, but as long as lunch is provided, they're very happy.
Oh, the emails that we'll receive. All right, there's going to be a lot of action today. These Olympics aren't over yet, and there'll be a little more action tomorrow. To which of the remaining events are you most eagerly looking forward?
Well, I'm actually going to up to the mountain for the first time. The U.S. bobsleigh team, which is what it's officially called, their four-man team, will be going for a gold medal. That hasn't happened since 1948, the year I was born, when basically it was an event for four fat guys using gravity.
And probably guys who wouldn't have looked too good in the suits they wear today.
No, I think they were using old football helmets.
John, winning and losing aside, the opening ceremonies are always dramatic. The closing ceremonies, likewise. Can you give us some idea of what we should be looking forward to as far as these closing ceremonies are concerned?
Well, what's going to be interesting is actually usually the closing ceremonies are held outdoors. This time, as the opening ceremonies were, the closing will be held inside. So you'll actually have two torches that will be extinguished. One will be downtown on the waterfront, and one will be inside. So this is a fitting close to the first spring Olympic Games.
John Powers is in Vancouver covering the 21st Olympic Games for the Boston Globe, and it is our pleasure to have him here on Only a Game from time to time as well. Thank you, John.
Thanks, Bill.
In men's hockey, the U.S. team continued their unlikely journey toward the final by overwhelming Finland 6-1. In the other semifinal late yesterday, the Canadian men's team edged Slovakia 3-2. They will try to match the achievement of the Canadian women's team by beating the U.S. for gold tomorrow. Monday marked the 30th anniversary of the U.S. Olympic hockey team's win over the Soviet Union in Lake Placid. After broadcaster Al Michaels' memorable, if not eternal, call, the upset win was dubbed the Miracle on Ice. But Dave Silk, a forward on the 1980 team that would go on to capture Olympic gold, prefers to remember that accomplishment somewhat differently.
I can hear the question asked by some well-meaning reporter in the year 2030. So, Dave, it's been 50 years since the miracle in Lake Placid. What were you thinking as you approached the big game with the vaunted Soviet Union? My live-in nursemaid, Ivushka, says, I'm sorry, but you'll have to speak up. Mr. Silk's hearing is spotty at best, and he refuses to wear his earpiece. And then I say, No, no, no. I heard the man. Okay, I'm going to tell you, but for the last time. Evie, bring me a glass of vodka. Four fingers, this way, as I tilt my hand in a north-to-south direction. And then I continue. Look, everybody's been reluctant to tell the truth because we're all scared that we'll ruin a good story. This is how it really was. We were a college all-star team. Some guys, as you would expect, went on to have great careers in the pros, while others went about living good and prosperous lives away from hockey. The miracle thing? Hell yeah, it was an upset of unbelievable proportions. But that possibility is what sports are all about. And hockey, by virtue of the fact that will, grit, and determination, not to mention clutch goaltending, thank you, Jim Craig, can trump skill in a one-game series at any time. A lot of things came together for us. A home crowd, momentum, a lethargic Soviet team, and a guy named Mark Johnson who basically carried us on his shoulders for 2 weeks. But you know what? Sweden, Canada, and the Finns could have knocked off the Soviets that night. They were really that ripe. It was a hockey game, and I consider Al Michaels' call, "Do you believe in miracles?" Yes! to be the real impetus behind elevating the game to biblical status. I would rather people consider the 1980 gold medal not as a legend, but as a benchmark in USA hockey. Now, don't get me wrong. It changed each and every one of our lives for the better, and I know that I'm grateful for all of the ways that the miracle has benefited me. But frankly, I think the story has jumped the shark. I mean, come on. How long is Arruzioni going to keep telling sales teams about how they can replicate our standard of excellence? He's freaking 100 years old! So what's my everlasting impression of 1980? Well, that's simple. We helped grow the game of ice hockey in the USA. Movies about the Mighty Ducks and NHL teams in Texas, Florida, and Arizona. Unheard of prior to Lake Placid. So I think the real accomplishment was this. We were pioneers, not heroes, and that's just fine. We took a sport that we loved, played as long as we could, and left it in better shape than we found it. Now, if you'll excuse me, all this talking has made me tired. I need a nap. Come, my little Lavushka.
Dave Silk had an assist in the game against the Soviets on February 22, 1980. He is currently a partner at Cadence Capital, an investment management firm in Boston. You can share your 1980 Lake Placid memories, miraculous, mundane, or mystified, or anywhere in between on our website, onlyagame.org. Nobody thought the U.S. was able until it's 19 minutes past the hour. First, understand that a special press-up, also known as an air press-up, is a push-up during which one's feet don't touch the floor. Next, consider how difficult it must be to perform 20 consecutive special press-ups. Now you can perhaps understand how Romanian Giuliano Stro has achieved the distinction of world's strongest five-year-old. Since young Giuliano recently turned that particular trick, shattering the previous record for special press-ups, which was 12. His dad has been taking Giuliano to the gym since shortly after the lad's birth, but he seems to have a sense of perspective about his son's achievement. If he gets tired or bored, said Giuliano's dad, we go and play. I'm Bill Littlefield. Ahead on Only a Game, I'll be joined by Nolan Richardson, well known for leading Arkansas to the 1994 NCAA Basketball Championship and better known for being fired. But first, during tomorrow's closing ceremonies in Vancouver, the Olympic flag will be handed over to Sochi, which will host the 22nd Winter Games. Representatives of the southern Russian city have been in Vancouver generating buzz over the last 2 weeks Only a Game's Sadie Babbitts recently made the trip to Vancouver's Sochi House, and she has this look ahead to the 2014 Winter Olympics.
It's the last Wednesday of the Winter Olympic Games. Hundreds of people wait outside in the rain to go inside Sochi House. This blue-domed marvel stands out on Vancouver's waterfront, a bold reminder that 4 years from now, Russia will host the Winter Olympics. Here, modern culture, like these Russian dancers with their skin-tight black clothing, is on display, along with traditional dancing and singing. Some 75,000 visitors during the Winter Olympics have wandered past Sochi House's wall-sized photographs of its Russian namesake's natural wonders. The photos dash any ideas that Russia is cold and gray. Sochi is actually subtropical. It's Russia's southernmost city of some 400,000 people. Ivan Sinyenko knows Sochi well. This former Moscow resident has gone to Sochi on vacation.
It's probably going to be similar to what Vancouver looks like. So it's mountains and it's Black Sea there, so it's very nice. It's very, very good microclimate there, so I'm sure it's going to be fun.
Well, the big question, though, is there going to be snow?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. Mountains always, it's a big mountain resort there, so it's kind of like Whistler. If not, they will make snow for sure, so no problem.
Sinyenko, like most visitors here, has come to see Russia's vision for the next Winter Olympics.
This is Olympic Village, and all the venues will be put in the same place, so it's walking distance everywhere.
Elena Zarkova works at Sochi House. Today, she proudly shows off a massive three-dimensional replica of Sochi and the Olympic venues. She clicks a button, and one of the miniature stadiums lights up.
So this is Olympic Stadium, opening and closing ceremony, hockey practice arena, and small short track for figure skating and short track.
These venues don't exist yet, but the $12 billion project is underway. The international airport is finished, new roads are going in to handle traffic, and some of these facilities, like the curling rink, will be mobile. So after the 2014 Games, they'll be taken apart and shipped throughout Russia to encourage winter sports. That's Russia's curling team after a photo shoot and tea time with Russian media. They're excited about showing the world just how hospitable and warm Russia can be in the literal and figurative sense. And they're even more thrilled that they'll someday have a real curling facility to practice on.
After the Olympics in Sochi, we will like inherit a lot of Olympic arenas that will help to develop the youth sport in our country.
That's Kira Aiza, speaking through one of her teammates.
And we do hope that we will have our own arena for curling, and we'll have the ability to have practice at home in Russia.
Not everyone shares the curling team's enthusiasm. Sochi doesn't have much land for development, so the government had to buy private land and homes to make way for the Olympic Village outside the city. That didn't go over well with locals. The mayor of Sochi, Anatoly Pakhomov, says regardless, the games will be good for the city and for the world.
And we guarantee that we will run the Olympics at the highest possible level. We will give the world the unforgettable feast of sports.
Pakhomov made his remarks during a special ceremony in which Vancouver's mayor agreed to share how the city put this year's Winter Games together. This is a long-standing Olympic tradition. It'll be followed Sunday with Vancouver passing the Olympic flag to Sochi for the 2014 Games.
Сегодня мы говорим спасибо Ванкуверу, до встречи в Сочи.
And today we say thank you, Vancouver. See you in Sochi.
For Only a Game, I'm Sadie Babbitts.
I think they look pretty nice. I mean, they're fun. I don't think they're actually denim. I think they're they're just made to look that way.
Canadian Mayelle Ricker didn't need the faux denim pants worn by the U.S. snowboarders. Ricker won the gold medal in snowboard cross sans denim, even if snowboarding is a sport where denim, or even faux denim, would seem to be a perfect fit. In terms of crowd appeal, the faux denim pants could not compete with the trousers worn by the Norwegian curlers. They are not exactly psychedelic, these pants, but they are multicolored, red, white, gray, and blue, in an argyle pattern so garish it might embarrass a Sunday golfer. Except that these pants were initially made for golfers. Anyway, according to Canadian curling fan Tracy Dolan, the shift from basic black has seriously increased the Norwegian curling team's fan base.
People in the crowd were all yelling, Norway's pants.
Yeah.
And we wondered what they were saying.
Yeah.
Christopher Sva, who plays second position on Norway's curling team, couldn't be more delighted with that development.
It's just crazy. So the crowd is cheering for us when they're not cheering for Canada, it seems like. Well, they're cheering for the pants, basically. Go pants, they say.
Like his teammates, Christopher Sva wore the black trousers traditionally favored by curlers everywhere until these games. Now he has high hopes for the new look.
Well, I hope that it'll make younger people start curling, because it's always so few, well, at least in Europe and Norway, it's so few juniors. It's just like old people playing. So if you can get a lot of new junior teams to start curling, because they see it's like young people playing that play maybe cool clothes or something like that, that should be good.
Håvard Vad Pedersen nods in agreement. He is the lead on the Norwegian team, which will compete for a gold medal today. As far as he's concerned, returning to basic black is not a sartorial option.
I can't imagine that happen now, no. I don't think so.
Those tubes of polyester on your legs, they're all red and green and yellow and blue. You'd need a metal detector to prove it. Man, I swear they're 88. Where did you get those pants?
You can view our Olympics photo gallery by visiting onlyagame.org. Share your Olympic fashion critiques or pointers on our Facebook and Twitter pages, username onlyagameradio.
Come buy some hippie in love. More phosphorescent than a moonlit shore.
40 Minutes of Hell, the title of Russ Bradford's book about basketball coach Nolan Richardson, refers to what Coach Richardson used to encourage his teams to impose on the opposition. As the head coach at the University of Arkansas, Richardson led his team to the national championship in 1994. He was also one of the first black men to coach a major sport at a predominantly white university. Russ Bradford joins me now from KRWG in Las Cruces, New Mexico. Russ, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. It's good to be back.
And we're also joined on the phone by Nolan Richardson. Coach, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you also. I'm very happy to be a part of it.
And if things don't work out in coaching, boy, do you have a radio voice.
More of a preacher. I'm thinking about going into that a little bit, too.
Excellent, excellent. Russ, you served as an assistant basketball coach at the Division I level for 14 years. What was it about your experience in that realm that eventually led you to think it would be a good idea to write a book about Nolan Richardson?
Well, like a lot of people, I saw that press conference that happened in 2002 in a room full of an all-white media at a time when it was supposed to be just another press conference before the game against Mississippi State. Coach Richardson talked about race and discrimination for about 40 minutes. And I thought, how did it happen that a guy goes from winning the national championship in 1994, a historic championship, to being fired and sort of crash landing a few years later? I also noticed that nearly everyone from the newspapers to television condemned Nolan Richardson and basically said that he'd gotten what he deserved. And I thought, there must be more to the story than this. It can't possibly be this simple.
Coach Richardson, when you learned about this project, did you immediately think, well, yeah, book about me, that would be fine?
Well, see, I'd been approached many times about a book being written about me over the years, and I wanted someone that lived in my area, someone that knew some of my background, knew some of the people who knew who I really was. I mean, and Russ was a coach at one time, so therefore I thought he would be able to give a fair, clean picture of it. Not everything that he wrote glorifies me. And so there were some things that I really didn't particularly like. But that's the reality of the book.
There is a good deal of history in this book, and not just the history of how Nolan Richardson made it to the top of the college basketball world from very difficult childhood circumstances in the Segundo Barrio section of El Paso. Russ, you include here the Tulsa race riot of 1921 and accounts of various confrontations between Arkansas authorities and the U.S. National Guard over civil rights. To what extent is that historical background necessary to Nolan Richardson's story?
I think we'd all agree that if we never talk about race and never talk about what happened in the past, that's not the answer. And neither do we need to talk about it every 5 minutes. But I think with Nolan Richardson, he wants to point out injustices of the past. And I think he's sort of the historical link. He wants us to remember guys like Clarence Big House Gaines and John McClendon, great coaches at the historically black colleges who never got a chance. Americans were cheated out of the greatest college games of all time. We never got to see Big House Gaines against Dean Smith or John McClendon against John Wooden for the NCAA championship. I feel that Nolan Richardson is the bridge to that history.
But you also write at one point in the book, it's actually at several points, that a lot of the people who have known Nolan Richardson, even lots of his friends, regard him as a man who always has had a chip on his shoulder and never forgets a slight, real or perceived. I'm paraphrasing here. Is that characterization accurate?
I think any kid who grows up in Segundo Barrio, he grew up in the poorest neighborhood in the most isolated city in America. And I think kids who grow up in that neighborhood have this sort of it's us against the world kind of feeling. The truth is, Bill, that Nolan Richardson's rise to the top of college basketball was the greatest against all odds struggle of any coach who's ever won the national title. No one had the deck stacked against him like Nolan Richardson did. But I think that's what fueled him as a coach. I think the first guy to break through could not have been someone who got along with everybody and was nice to everyone and never talked about race. And I think what Nolan Richardson and Muhammad Ali and Jim Brown and Bill Russell, guys like that, have done is made it possible for Tiger Woods never to talk about race and made it possible for Michael Jordan never to talk about race. The guys who broke through had to be brash and confident, and I think that's precisely who he is.
Coach, I have to give you a chance to refute the idea that you never forgot a slight, real or perceived.
I personally never thought I carried a chip on my shoulder. I was raised by a grandmother who taught me more than any books. Mm-hmm. And so when you grow up and you're not allowed to sleep in the same hotel with your teammates, or you're not allowed to eat in the same restaurant with your teammates, you take that. And she was a big Jackie Robinson fan. Mm-hmm. She would always talk to me about Jackie had to do those things in order for us to have a chance. You're not only playing for you or in your family. You're playing for a lot of families, son. So, you know, I had that kind of a deal going with me. And then my voice. I can't help it because I'm 6'3", 230, and have a voice like this. I mean, you know, every time I said, hey, that don't mean I'm angry. That's just my voice, you know. And sometimes the voice was good because when I said hey to my players, they knew what hey mean. Let's go.
You had the reputation of a man who always inspired his players by telling them that nobody else respected them. All the other college coaches had ignored them, had not recruited them. I understand that as a motivational tool, but how did you use that strategy when your teams were ranked number one, number two, among the best in the whole country?
You know, I don't think I told my teams all the time that they were not wanted. Matter of fact, I encouraged them in many different ways. Old Granny would always say there's more than one way to skin a cat. So I skinned that cat as many different ways. If we had the cat that I needed to say, hey, do I kick this one or do I pat this one? Or you are up on the top. How long do you think that you're going to be on the top? It's not but one step from the outhouse to the penthouse. Or one step below from the penthouse, you're in the outhouse.
I'm speaking with basketball coach Nolan Richardson and his biographer Russ Bradford, the author of 40 Minutes of Hell. You're listening to Only a Game. Russ, as you point out in 40 Minutes of Hell, at least in terms of numbers, times have changed for the better since Nolan Richardson was one of a very small number of black head coaches at Division I schools. To what extent is he responsible for the progress?
Between John Thompson and John Chaney and Nolan Richardson, they're totally responsible. And it wasn't just that those three guys won in a big way. and were confident and brash and talked about race and opportunity, but they also got the black coaches organized. The Black Coaches Association became a major force in the hiring practices in college basketball, and that was precisely because the three guys at the top of the letterhead were Nolan Richardson, John Thompson, and John Chaney. Football coaches have never been organized in the same way. They need a Nolan Richardson or a John Thompson, not just to win and win big, but to get the other coaches organized.
Coach, do you think Arkansas, as part of your legacy perhaps, gets the respect that the program deserves when they talk about great basketball programs now, the Dukes and UCLAs of the world?
I don't see that today. No, I think it's pretty much football and basketball has come on rough times. But, you know, when you talk to people that are a little bit older about basketball, Arkansas is mentioned quite a bit. And, of course, our style of play was a lot different than most styles. I see more of the style that I thought we played, and going back to John McClendon, who was a fast break guy, it disappeared because it became rat ball or the N-word ball or alley ball, or, you know, they called it everything, and now it's fast break and up tempo. They got nice names for it, you know. So I understand. I understand how the evolution of the game has changed. So I remember playing in New York with Tulsa team, and we stepped out of bounds and threw a long touchdown pass, and Digger was the announcer, and the first thing he said, he said, "See what I mean? It doesn't take them long to shoot the ball." I said, "Well, hell, it's a layup. What do you want me to do?" So, you know, it depends on who you're listening to, you know, about the best teams in the country.
Russ Bradford is the author of 40 Minutes of Hell, The Extraordinary Life of Nolan Richardson, published by HarperCollins. Russ, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
And Nolan Richardson, the subject of the book, has coached the national basketball teams of Panama and Mexico since leaving the University of Arkansas. He will next be on the sideline for the WNBA's Tulsa Shock. Coach, thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, thank you very much, Bill.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. And Harvard University, whose Harvard Summer School offers courses for high school, college, and adult students to earn academic credit and experience Harvard campus life. summer.harvard.edu. This is NPR.
A topless sled race scheduled to occur in Germany almost didn't happen when the venue's mayor, Mirko Ernst, opined that, quote, the good name of Oberwiesenthal is at stake. Obviously, safety wasn't the worry, since the competitors were required to wear helmets and shoes. The more streamlined participants wore not much else. The mayor's concern notwithstanding, 30 male and female competitors raced along a 100-meter track in the snow. More than 14,000 spectators also showed up, and though nearly all of them kept their clothes on, one 70-year-old gentleman decided to get into the spirit of the competition, stripped to his long johns, and went rocketing down the hill, reportedly to the day's loudest and longest round of applause.
Let's just get naked.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, learning to play to the whistle in life. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Despite NBC's bellyaching about losing money on these Olympics, the network has pulled down some impressive numbers. An average of 25 million viewers have been falling asleep during, watching during prime time, 20% more than watched the games in 2006. Are you surprised?
Well, no. I mean, as bad as I feel for the people on the West Coast of the United States who are apparently seeing everything on tape delay, there's more live stuff. There are more compelling stories. The United States hockey team, I'm sure, has been a big factor in moving these ratings up. So, no, I'm not surprised. I'm surprised neither by the fact that NBC is losing money over these because they overbid wildly, nor am I surprised that the ratings are good.
American Billy DeMung had a pretty busy day on Thursday. He gave the United States a first gold medal in the Nordic combined. Then he was asked to carry the U.S. flag in the closing ceremonies. And to top it off, he proposed to his girlfriend. He didn't have time to cure any major disease.
No, I hope he's not too confused and carries the flag at the closing ceremonies instead of like holding up his fiance and marching into the stadium with her.
Wife carrying. What else in this week's Olympics action has particularly delighted, surprised, or horrified you, Charlie?
You know, the no-fun-of-any-kind Dean Vernon Wormer international, you know, sports figures knuckling the Canadian women's hockey team for drinking beer and smoking cigars.
Shock, shock.
And, you know, running Scotty Lego out of town because he enjoyed himself after winning the competition. Those things don't surprise me. On Thursday night, the ladies' free skate, which settled the medals in women's figure skating, compelling stories up and down the line, but once again, figure skating is a very, very tough room. Mariah Osada of the United States skated fourth after Joanie Rochette, whose mother had passed away, who was in third place. And you and I both know, Bill, that Ms. Osada could have jumped and done a 40 million salchow. She could still be up there spinning. And there was absolutely no way she was going to medal because the judges wanted to get out of British Columbia alive.
Things have gone from bad to worse to somewhere just north of worst for the Washington Wizards. Following the suspensions of Gilbert Arenas and Javaris Crittenden, the team now has to do without Josh Howard, whom the Wizards had just acquired from Dallas 2 weeks earlier. Do you think Josh Howard would have suffered a season-ending knee injury if he'd still been a Maverick?
Now, there's only one way this could have happened outside of Washington, and that is if Josh Howard had been traded to the Clippers.
I was thinking the same thing.
Where he would have torn both ACLs and broken both legs.
Athletes usually like to be the first to accomplish something, Charlie, but somehow I don't think Hashim Thabeet is celebrating his latest accomplishment. What do you think?
Well, Hashim was the number two pick overall in the draft. He went to the Memphis Grizzlies, and he has become the highest draft pick ever sent to the developmental league by an NBA team. He's gotten been sent off to the Dakota Wizards, which was discovered by a website which covers the D-League extensively, somebody has to apparently, called RidiculousUpside.com.
Bob Knight, with 902 wins, no longer holds the record for a men's NCAA basketball coach. Philadelphia University presented coach Herb McGee with his 903rd NCAA win on Monday night. Okay, okay, Philadelphia University plays D2, but anything that takes Bob Knight down a peg is good, right?
Absolutely. Don Meyer, who retired Monday from Northern State, has 922. Some of those are in the old NAIA. Yeah, Herb McGee managed to battle past Goldie Beacom College on Tuesday night. I'm sorry, Bob, but that's just the way it goes, although it's got to be tempting for him to come back and win a few games.
It's too bad. I had Goldie Beacom in the role of spoiler that night. In Southbridge, Massachusetts, officials of the Tri-Community YMCA basketball program have banned parents from attending games. Why?
Get out! Now! Parents were misbehaving watching their 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th graders who played once a week. They were yelling at referees. They were yelling at each other. Police have not yet been called, but the officials say we're going to stop this before we have to.
This week, a British rugby player became the first athlete to be suspended for using human growth hormone. The apparent success of the test has led to reports that Major League Baseball will screen minor league players for HGH, and the NFL Players Union has now come out in opposition to HGH testing for their members. Detecting HGH requires a blood test. Are we likely to see that test in the major leagues anytime soon?
Oh, sure, because we're all nuts about drugs. You know that. This is incredibly invasive. It's even deeper in violation of privacy than the urine cup is. We don't even know what this stuff does yet. But it's a drug, and it's a performance enhancer. So, by God, take all the painkillers you want.
Tiger Woods' lawyers have not yet been able to stop paparazzi from following his children, but they have at least temporarily stopped PETA from putting up a billboard near his home in Withermore, Florida. What? Does Mr. Woods object to the spaying and neutering of animals?
No, he objects to being the poster child for spaying and neutering of animals, I think. It's a picture of Tiger Woods with the legend, "Too much sex can be a bad thing."
All right, Charlie, quiz time. A woman named Katie Coates is leading the charge to bring a new test sport to the 2012 Olympics in London. Ms. Coates would like to see more formal inclusion for this sport, which boasts competitors from more than 11 countries, in time for the 2016 Games. And that sport is?
Pole dancing.
Excellent.
Which is really wonderful, although I'm not entirely sure if they're going to have judges on the competition floor or people just handing dollar bills out. This sport is apparently not to be confused with of course not.
With his sister activity. And finally, Charlie, women and men do not compete on equal terms in very many athletic contests, but they did recently, according to London's Daily Telegraph, in Trivial Pursuit. You can't make fun of this. You're a guy who enjoys the odd game of trivia of a Monday night at the pub, so I'll let you report on the result.
Women answered 4,088,139 questions correctly compared to the 4,077,596 right answers given by men. And the most popular overall category was entertainment.
And the women won.
Of course they did.
Okay. Charlie Pierce writes for the Sunday Boston Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
If you've heard just about enough stories of glory, honor, and redemption over the last 2 weeks, you may be interested to learn about a group of athletes in Concord, Massachusetts that simply seeks to play. Only a Game's Karen Given has the story.
Every Tuesday night during basketball season, Lou Burkholz puts on a funny hat so that the kids will recognize him and walks the sidelines of the Concord Armory. Burkholz is a curriculum consultant for the Doc Wayne Athletic League, and his favorite part of his job is how normal it all seems.
You really, I mean, I don't think you'd know this is anything other than really average high school basketball.
But look closer and you'll see the differences. Some players can't dribble, while others shoot perfect layups. Some are learning disabled, and others are serving sentences handed down by the juvenile justice system. 60% are wards of the state, 80% are survivors of physical or sexual abuse, and all of the players in the Doc Wayne League are in residential treatment, with the goal of becoming healthy enough to do things that most teenagers take for granted. Live at home, go to school, and play on a sports team.
If you take even 30 seconds just to think about what you think you might know about these kids, then like I think the whole landscape opens up to what the real story is, because every single one of these kids has a story. I mean, and a story that will make you ill.
For 1 hour a week, these kids, who spend most of their days working through what they call their stuff, are asked to put those stories behind them and just play basketball. But make no mistake, playing sports in the Doc Wayne League is therapy, and that therapy sounds a little like this.
My goal for tonight is to play to the whistle, build my team, fill my tank, show up.
The Doc Wayne Athletic League teaches players life skills through common sports sayings. A coach might remind his girls to play to the whistle when they're 10 points down with just a minute to play, and he hopes that they'll remember that phrase when they're having trouble with a quiz at school. Combine that simple idea with exercise, and you have a formula that works, at least for Annika, a 14-year-old, heavily pierced, faux hawk-wearing resident of the Walden Street School in Concord.
It's really awesome. Like, I mean, before I was kind of angry, but, like, when coming on the court, it makes me, like, it releases everything. Like, it gives me an adrenaline rush and makes, like, endorphins, I guess. Like, they're just everywhere. And I don't know, I get really happy and excited.
Ask most of the girls in Doc Wayne why they're here, and they'll tell you they just want to have fun. But Annika has something bigger in mind.
I think my main goal is to kind of, like, learn to leave everything else behind. And, like, I mean, because we are supposed to keep our heads in the game. We're not supposed to, like, bring all our problems with us. So I guess it just teaches me to, like, leave everything behind and go with the flow.
That's the kind of talk Susan Wayne likes to hear. Wayne started this league in 2002 in honor of her late brother, a pediatric surgeon called Doc. Today, about 400 kids, male and female, play basketball, soccer, softball, and flag football in the Doc Wayne League. From her borrowed office overlooking Boston's picturesque Copley Square, Wayne gets misty-eyed when thinking about the league she founded.
It's a beautiful thing to see. A number of people who I've invited will stand there sort of crying. You know, they actually have tears in their eyes. And the kids aren't crying. They're having a great time. We're standing there crying.
Last year, Wayne commissioned Wendy DeAndrea, a postdoctoral fellow at the Justice Resource Institute's Trauma Center, to study the League. Compared to their classmates, Doc Wayne participants improved on everything from levels of depression and anxiety to talking out of turn in class and starting fights. And they needed dramatically fewer restraints. DeAndrea says it's rare to find therapies that really work for these kids, and it was a joy to watch the improvement over the course of a single basketball season.
The first few games were just sort of depressing. Nobody sort of knew what to do. They didn't really want to be there. And then they kept coming back, so there was something that roped them in.
As the girls learned to play, tempers started to flare. DeAndrea says these are kids who often had to fight for their survival. And even an innocent bump on the court could easily escalate.
After like two or three games like that, it was like we brought in a whole new group of kids. It was like there were kids we'd never seen before. They would knock into each other, and you know, one girl would say like, "Oh, my bad, sorry, don't know what to do with my feet," or someone else on the other team would be crying, and the other team would do a cheer for her. Like it was just incredibly sweet.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten. It's now a year after DeAndrea saw those results, and the girls in Concord are warming up for their last game of the regular season. This year saw far fewer growing pains, thanks in part to some changes to the rules. Craig Babineau is the athletic administrator for the Doc Wayne Athletic League and one of the referees charged with keeping the girls safe on the court. He says the kids take what they learn here back to the residences.
It's amazing when you hear the kids using the language. And they'll give it to you, too. They'll be like, if you leave a dish out by the... They're like, that's not playing to the whistle on that bowl of cereal, coach.
The lowest scoring game of the season was 2-4 after 40 minutes. Blowouts of 30-2 are relatively common. But the league's success isn't measured by the numbers on the scoreboard.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6!
Babineau points to the front court where a team calling itself the VIC, or Very Important Commits, is playing the Walden Warriors. On the Walden side, a shorter brunette named Vanessa is in constant motion.
When I first came to Walden, she was the kind of player that if someone said anything to her, there was anything in the game, she would go right after the kid, physical altercation, just very fiery like that.
Tonight, 17-year-old Vanessa hasn't lost any of her desire to win. But listening in as she addresses her team at the end of the game, you'd never know they'd lost.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Girls, you guys make me so proud. I'm, like, glad to say I was your captain this year. Like, really, you guys are amazing.
How do you think Jaden and I feel? Absolutely.
I just want to give everybody a high five.
Vanessa reminds everyone to go to school and, quote, suck it up when you're about to flip out. Playing in the Doc Wayne League is a privilege for these girls, and Vanessa sees it as her job to make sure everyone makes it to their next game.
I say that a lot to people. I say it to myself. Someone says something to somebody, like, people snap back. I'm just like, it's okay, like, we have a game. Don't want to, like, lose going to the game. And when I get upset, I'll be like, no, I have a game on Tuesday. I need to control myself.
It's 2.5 weeks later, and 15-year-old Maggie leads her team in a cheer before their semifinal game against the undefeated Cottage Hill Mustangs. Maggie doesn't look much like a high school basketball player, but she's introduced to me as a Doc Wayne athlete superstar, and that's exactly what she is, in every way that matters. After 2.5 years living at Germain Lawrence, a school that caters to girls battling behaviors from cutting to fire setting, Maggie has been accepted to a group home, and she credits Doc Wayne for much of her success.
We are able to really express ourselves in an athletic way instead of being criticized. Like, yeah, maybe some people don't have the most athletic ability, but they get better because the teammates that they have and the coaches and the referees that we have all really size them up and are like, you can do this if you put your heart to it. And it really kind of makes everybody just pretty much happy and confident with themselves.
Maggie says she was a couch potato when she first started playing in Doc Wayne, and now she's proud to call herself an athlete. She also says she's learned things that go far beyond the basketball court.
If you knock somebody over and help them back up, that's definitely, like, not only a good thing on the court, but also when you're walking through, like, the street. If you bump into somebody, be like, oh, I'm sorry, or, like, you know, in the classroom, be like, you need some help with this.
And is that something you didn't realize when you first came to the school?
That is something I had no idea of.
Tonight's semifinal goes into overtime, the length of which is determined by how much time remains before the league gets shooed out of the gym. After trading the lead, the Mustangs win, final score 26-22. Despite the hard loss, Maggie is still grinning from ear to ear, and her coach Betty is still singing the team's praises.
You guys played this game out until the end. Like, you guys definitely played to the whistle, to the end, all the way to the end on every possession right there, and you guys should be very proud of yourselves.
The Jermaine Lawrence Pumas ended their basketball season in fourth place. Maggie is still in the process of moving out of Jermaine Lawrence and into a group home. And for the rest of the girls in the Doc Wayne League, flag football season starts on Tuesday. For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given.
All right, girls, remember, nothing but good game, okay? Here we go. Nothing but good game.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Parati. Our intern is Tyler Murray. We had help this week from John Cohn at KRWG in Las Cruces. And our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view Sadie Babbitt's photos from Vancouver, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast or listen to archived shows and stories, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. To share your opinions about stories you've heard on Only a Game and to get behind-the-scenes information about the show, you can visit our Facebook and Twitter pages, username Only a Game Radio. Our final word is from Doc Wayne Athletic League hoopster Amanda, who responds to the question, does it matter if your team wins?
Nope. Just that we played hard. We're a very classy team.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Thank you for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Mini, featuring the 37-mile-per-gallon Mini Cooper with go-kart handling. Learn more at miniusa.com/info. The Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, committed to helping Americans lead healthier lives and get the care they need, on the web at rwjf.org. And the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. This is NPR.